Let's pray. Father, thanks for laughter and for life and for just the joy of being together. Thanks for our kids. Our desire is to raise them in ways that honor you, so they will honor each other as well, and that they will be led to partners that have a desire to honor you. So help us tonight in this discussion, in Christ's name. It's tough to be a kid today. It's not the same as when we were kids in so many ways. We have some friends that just moved to California and went to see a doctor, and the 8-year-old went to see a doctor for a problem and was telling the 10-year-old in the van after about the appointment. And the mom's driving, and the 8-year-old says, and the doctor touched my private parts. And the 10-year-old said, why? And the 8-year-old said, I think it had something to do about erectile dysfunction. The mom just about drove off the road because he had no clue. But it's a statement about our culture, is it not? That he had heard that so often. They're a sports family. They watch everything. And you'll hear that at least, 100 times on a weekend if you watch sports. It's a new day and age as we raise our children.
And so what we're going to be talking about tonight is how can we help prepare our children so that they marry well, so that we hopefully send this legacy into the next generation of pointing others to Christ. And it's a hard sell in the day in which we're living. You know, I'm guessing that if we had 6 years ago in this room said, probably in the year 2010, state by state would be voting on how to define marriage, we probably would have said, are you crazy? And yet, in very, very short order, that which has been believed since the beginning of time has been turned upside down. And the messages that are coming at our kids are fast and furious, that marriage is an old-fashioned idea, that it's outdated, that really marriage is just when anybody loves anybody. The propaganda that's constantly coming at you, I don't know if we're very aware of how much it ultimately affects us on a subconscious level, which allows us to open some doors and windows to things that we never thought we would open. But I want to read you a little part of an article that came across the internet last week. For us, the title of the article is Ever After Just Too Long? Marriage and Modernity. The announcement that Al and Tipper Gore are separating after 40 years of marriage has captured the attention of the American public to a rather surprising degree. After all, divorce is hardly uncommon these days, and the Gores are famously part of the baby boom generation, the generation of couples with the highest divorce rate in history. Gil Troy, who teaches American history at Canada's McGill University, told the New York Times, quote, in a sense, getting divorced is the iconic baby boomer act. A few days later, along came Betsy Stevenson of the University of Pennsylvania to report that couples who married in the 1970s were the, quote, greatest divorcing generation. She acknowledged sadness in the Gore's announcement, but suggested that we should celebrate, quote, how much optimism they now have for the rest of their lives. Writing at the New Republic, Michelle Cottle was even more cheery, arguing that it's just fine that middle-aged couples divorce. I mean, 40 years of marriage is, quote, an impressive chunk of time to spend together, she asserted. But the expectation that marriage means staying together into the next phase of adult life is unreasonable. The story of the Gores, she insisted, is a classically American tale with its themes of hope and promise and new beginnings. The Gores aren't offering explanations, but marital therapists and divorce attorneys say the breakup of long-term marriages is routine these days for reasons of longevity, economics, and cravings for happiness and self-expression that were less prevalent in previous generations. People are living longer, and they're less willing to spend their last decades with someone who leaves them unfulfilled. At the same time, working wives are less dependent on husbands for financial support, and husbands now have Viagra and other new incentives to find other romances. This is the quote that turned me upside down, though. Zaslow cites anthropologist Margaret Mead, who obviously herself is a moral revolutionary, who argued that, quote, marriage was designed for a time when people died in their 40s and 50s after raising children together. Now that we're living longer and we're healthier, couples are just bored with each other. Do you realize that statement? Marriage was designed for a time when people lived only till their 40s and 50s. Really? Like, how about 850 or 950 years? Talk about a long marriage. But when things...
Talk about long-suffering. I mean, that is...
You're already feeling better, aren't you? But when things like this are in print, do you realize that the average person believes there's some truth to it? And so the toxicity towards marital longevity, towards the covenant nature of marriage, becomes less and less real and more distant, especially to the generations that we are part of today. And so part of what we're going to talk about tonight is, what is God looking for in all of this? What does he want us to do with our kids to prepare them to understand his design for marriage?
Because we counsel couples, and granted, they usually don't come in because they're having a great time. But when we talk to them and are trying to find out what's going on, we start going back. They'll tell us, and you go back, and somewhere it gets, well, I'm not sure I married the right person. And then we say, well, tell us about who you're hanging around with. And I think probably, I don't know, this may be a little late, but probably around fourth grade, we start making the most significant decisions on who we're going to marry. And that's what we want to convince you of tonight. That the issue of marriage and the problem we're having is much more one of parenting than it is of adults making bad choices. Four. I said all the way to four. Yeah, it could be earlier, but four. We'll go a little later. Okay? First. Did I say fourth grade?
Yeah.
Oh, 4 years probably, but fourth grade is fine. Either one. The point is, it's early. Have we prayed tonight yet? Did we pray? Half said yes and half said no. That is really troubling. Okay, we're going to pray. Father, in these moments, we did pray, I think. Yeah. Father, apparently my wife thinks we need to pray again, so please help us. Amen. Okay. So, on your sheet, there are a number of things, and we are going to really just hit the mountaintops or the peaks on these. So first is, have a plan for your children. Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord builds a house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. 3 John verse 4 is our verse as a couple. I have no greater joy than to know my children are walking in the truth. We moved from California to New England in 1991, and we found that they think really differently about education in New England than in the West. They take it seriously. They want to make sure their children get into these prestigious schools. They'll actually enroll them before they're born to get them on the right waiting list, get them right in the nursery, So it just struck me, you know, it's not like California where the major issue is how to surf, you know, when I'm out of class, you know, that sort of thing. So I was speaking at my first church sermon, and I said, it seems that you people in New England are more interested that your children get into Harvard than heaven. I never spoke there again, but but it's true. It's true. Because people in New England would never say, well, whatever my child wants to do, I can't determine whether they go to school or not. I can't determine whether they go to a prep school or not. No, they have a goal for them, and they're going to do everything they can. And yet, so often as parents, we don't have a faith goal. Church I was on staff at had 105th graders, 106th graders, 57th graders, 58th graders, 25 ninth graders, 20 10th graders, 15 11th graders, and 10 12th graders. That's a 90% drop off. And the parents are still going to church. Well, why aren't those kids there? Because the parents said, well, he doesn't want to go. Well, you don't, when the kid says, I don't want to go to high school, you don't say, well, that's fine. I'm not going to tell you what to do. We always tell our children what to do if we believe in it enough, right? So it's an issue of having a plan for them. I'm done on that point. Do you wish to talk anymore? Secondly, help them see your delight in Christ and in his word. Philippians 4:9, whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice and the God of peace will be with you. Howard talked about this morning. What an incredible statement to say to our children. Look at me. Look at me. You don't have to say it. They are. Ray Johnson, who's coming next week, one of our speakers, did youth work forever. And he said the number one reason that he believes kids do not continue in the faith, and 80 to 90% of high schoolers walk out of church and never come back. And he said the reason is, he says, it's because of their parents. They look at their parents and say, why would I want to grow up and be like that? Dad says, son, when you get as old as I am, I hope you have as much joy in the Lord as I do. The day I accepted Jesus was the best day of my life, and it's been so exciting ever since. Well, what kid's going to want to do that? I mean, if you've got the joy of the Lord in your heart, would you mind notifying your face? You know, there should be. Now, that doesn't mean we're laughing all the time, but that should mean there's vitality. And our kids, as Howard said so well this morning, our kids should be seeing this vitality in us. That's what we love. We love Jesus. We love doing his work. We love keeping his values. And that's what we're about.
And so the established truth is that kids do imitate. In Ephesians 5:1, it says, be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love. And I've reflected so often on raising our own kids that I remember painfully the things that they imitated that I didn't really want them to imitate. Isn't it true? And it seems sometimes that there's Teflon in imitating the behavior that I really did want them to imitate. I remember when Carrie was 4 and Lisa was 2 and Lisa was being potty trained, and I was in the kitchen of our house in Avalon, and I hear these little voices from the bathroom, Mama, we need you. So I went running back into the bathroom to walk in on the scene of Carrie sitting on the big potty reading a Good Housekeeping magazine. And Lisa was on the little potty chair. She had an Osterizer cookbook turned upside down. And I said, what did you need, girls? We just need more magazines. And I remember thinking, I don't think I trained them to read in the bathroom or to see this as the library extension, but they picked it up. So they naturally imitate, and it's...
Not their father. There's one reason you go into that room. Well, two technically, but you think I'm fevered?
He does have a fever tonight. And so they imitate us. And I do want to just parenthetically say right here that there's some in this room that will hear that and you will not sleep tonight, because you're sure that the things that they're going to imitate from your life are the very things that you really don't want them to, and you're pretty hard on yourself, and you really believe that you are responsible 100% for whatever your child picks up along the line. And again, as Howard has said in a variety of ways this week, we are not determinative ultimately in our children's lives, though it's greatly incumbent on us to do everything we can to create an environment for them to come to know the authenticity of Jesus. Yeah, it's hot, probably for you more than for us. But and so let me just say quickly that one of the best things that we model for our children is the humility of confession. When we blow it with them, can I just tell you that the majority of high school and college students we talk to who are raised in Christian homes feel that their parents have never really apologized to them. They will say, no, my parents never owned their stuff. And since we know a lot of these parents, we are absolutely certain that those parents have said they're sorry to their kids. But what we've observed over time and what we know the tendency was in ourselves once that apology was given, it was usually followed with an explanation. Or as we say, whatever follows the but is what you actually believe. And so when you say, I'm really sorry that I blew it, I shouldn't have yelled at you, I shouldn't have called you that, I should have followed through on what I said, but if you hadn't, or if you had, and the minute that but is inserted there, every child hearing it knows that you're now shifting the blame from yourself to them, and it leaves them with the instruction in how to enter the great human pastime of the blame game. And so let me just say, as we imitate, is what we model, is one of the best things we model to them is the humility of our being changed into Christ's likeness. We had a young family we were mentoring in New England whose 10-year-old got an iPod for Christmas. And within 6 weeks of Christmas, he stuck it in his cargo pants one day and forgot about it before he tossed those cargo pants into the laundry. And they washed with the iPod in them. And in case you don't know, iPods don't wash well. They're not wash and wear. And so it came out of the washing machine, and it didn't work. So dad and son went to the local Apple store and explained to the technician that they had washed the iPod and that it wasn't working. Was there any hope for this iPod? And the guy behind the counter said, no. He said, once an iPod's been washed, it's pretty much toast. You're going to have to get a new one. But he said, you know, it's so new. I'll tell you what I would do if I were you. There's an Apple store in the town just down the street. And if you go into them and you just tell them that your iPod isn't working and you don't really know why, they'll replace it. I mean, it's only 6 weeks old. And the dad looked at the technician. You know these awkward situations where you know the guy's just trying to be helpful, but you know it's really illegal what he's suggesting that you do. So the dad, as he told the story to us, looked at the guy and said, I really appreciate that you just want to help us out. But we do know what happened to the iPod, so we really can't tell them that we don't. So we'll just have to get a new iPod. When he told us that story, I just want to tell you, I had chills. I have chills every time I tell the story because I think of that 10-year-old kid standing there at that counter, and he will hear hundreds of sermons on how important it is to be integrous, of the character of Christ's likeness is honorable, it's trustworthy, and none of those sermons will make nearly the impact as those 10 minutes did at that Apple store when his dad modeled something worth following. Our kids desperately need to be able to imitate Christ-like behavior in us.
Thirdly, be there for them. John 1:14 says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Our children just need us. They need time. Again, Howard and we haven't compared notes, but we never hear anybody say that. We had our staff go around and talk about the things they appreciate about their parents and that, and none of it had to do with what they had, where they lived. It had to do with character and being there, family things they did. Our daughter, Julie, who just came in tonight, and Julie and Lisa played three season sports at their school, and we just made it just a definite priority to be at their games, all of them, if we could. My temperament is very scattered. I never think of anything until the minute. So when the schedule came for the year, I would just give it, or for the season, to my assistant. I'd go in and say, what do I have today? She said, 10, you have this, 1, you have this, and that 2, you need to leave for Pingree because the girls have a game. So it was just, we were there. I very seldom would ever miss. One day, Julie came home and said one of her teammates turned 16 that day, and her present was a brand new BMW. So she told us about that, and we said, you know, what a lot of parents say, oh, that's interesting. You know, like, dream on, sweetheart, you know. So, but 2 weeks later, she came to us, and she said, you know, I was out on the field today, and that same girl, BMW girl, looked up and pointed to you and said, I'd give it all back. She said, I've played 3 sports for 4 years. My parents have never been to one game. So Julie came home and told us that, and we said, yeah, it was either go to your games or get you a Beamer. We decided to go to your games. But, you know, Beamers wear out. Long after you don't have the Beamer, you have memories that Dad and Mom were never there. I mean, that's hard for me to fathom. Never there. Our kids want us, and there are so many pressures on us. Some in here. Kristen and Bill talked about their move. One of the reasons they moved to Reno was not to gamble, but to get into a slower life pace where they could move into a house that didn't cost as much, where Bill didn't have to be in such a pressure job. Why? Because there's a greater value than living in Orange County and both working so you can have the house. What's the greater value? And then you make your decisions accordingly. And it may be you move to Kansas, or Reno, or downsize, or whatever.
I think one of the really important questions that you ask in this journey of parenting is, what is particular to this season of time that will not be available to us 5 or 10 years from now? I kind of felt in our lives we tried to work backwards of that. Okay, if I add 10 years to where we are right now, what am I going to look back on and say, oh, rats, I missed it? And I will just tell you, from advanced degrees to different business opportunities to living in different places, all of those opportunities, to be quite honest, are going to be there. I just read that a 92-year-old lady graduated from college. I think that is fabulous. And I think it illustrates that there are just a whole lot of things that always are going to be out there somewhere that we can get them. And there are some things that will not be. And from our vantage point now, having a 30-year-old, 27, and 25-year-old children, we can just tell you, you cannot turn the clock back on your kids. These days, as frustrating as they can be at times and as joyful as they can be at times, you get a once through when it comes to raising our families. And so grab what you can at this season that isn't going to be available to you 10 years from now.
Then give them convictions. Genesis 39:9, speaking of Joseph, no one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? You know, Joseph had day after day temptation, and no one to tell. Everything was perfect. The only thing that kept Joseph ultimately from sinning that day was, how could I do this against God? It was conviction. And that is so critical, that we see that as our goal, to teach our children conviction. We're living in a culture that is getting worse and worse and worse, right? We're talking about light. You know, we as Christian parents often try to take darkness out, but no matter how much darkness, it's always darkness. You cannot take darkness away. The world's going to always be dark. The only way you make change is introducing light, right? Listen to this from our great state of Massachusetts. Elementary school students in Provincetown, Mass. Can now acquire condoms at school, and parents can be assured their children will receive proper instruction about the use of those condoms. Children as young as grade one will be able to ask for condoms without parental consent, thanks to a new policy recently approved by the town's school council. The policy requires students to talk to a school nurse or counselor before receiving condoms. Now that gives you a lot of comfort, doesn't it? But does not set any age restrictions to the distribution. And then listen to this. Also, schools will not honor parents' requests who do not want their children to be given condoms. Now, there are reasons to move out of areas because of what it is. But let me tell you, the reason that I read that with convictions is in our culture today, the only thing that's going to get your kids through is convictions, not better rules. I mean, this policy means nothing if your child is strong enough. I mean, nobody's forcing them to take a condom. But they have to go in with strong enough convictions not to take a condom or not to be lured into that. And when they get into college, especially, if they don't have the convictions by then, I remember driving to the airport. Our oldest daughter, Carrie, went to Germany for her freshman year. I'll never forget looking in the back in the rearview mirror and thinking, this is it. What she doesn't have now, she won't get from us. I mean, it's pretty much, she's not going to call from Germany saying, can I go out drinking? She's not going to say, can I go to this movie? She's not going to say. The conviction she has are the convictions she's taking with her. That's why it's so critical that we are in situations where they're growing in their faith, not just relationships. I think the reason high school and junior high ministry is such an abysmal failure is it's focused on relationship, focused on kids having a good time. The junior highers and high schoolers don't have to have a good time. That's not the primary reason you take them to church. Because when they go to college, what are they going to want? A good time. And where do they find a good time? Sororities, fraternities, clubs. But they need to go with this conviction.
And then we're going to just toss the ball back to you and say that they're going to gain their understanding of your convictions by how you live your life. You know, the story of our friend at the iPod, with the iPod, modeled a conviction that was life-giving. And, you know, you've heard it said many times that more is caught than taught with our kids. And so if we are committed to living lives of integrity, then we're going to pass up the opportunity to stand at the gates of Disneyland with our very small 12-year-old and pass her off as a 9-year-old because the ticket is so much cheaper. And we're going to avoid the opportunities we have to bootleg software or DVDs or CDs or whatever we're sharing with one another to save Christ money. I mean, it's just such a little slippery slope. I mean, going to movie theaters, this is a tough one, but when it says right on the door, no outside food allowed, and we've justified because it costs $9 to get into the ridiculous movie anyway, and we know we're going to be able to buy it in about 3 months for less than that, we justify the smuggled in goods to the movie theater. But if our kids can read, can I just tell you that they've just figured out that we live somewhere outside of the law. And so we're modeling our own convictions there. And for our children to have a sense of bottom line convictions, let us just remind us that we have a great deal to do with communicating that to them.
That's a little too convicting. Let's go on to the next section. Okay. And this next one is, I really believe, how we strengthen our convictions and how our children. Give our children a love for the church. Give our children a love for the church. It's God's institution. It's his institution that is to go on. Young Life isn't his institution. InterVarsity isn't his institution. FCA isn't his institution. God uses all of those, but his institution is a church. So you want them to love the church. Hebrews 10:25 says, let us not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another and all the more as you see the day approaching. Psalm 122:1. I was, what's that word? Glad when they said, when my parents said, let's get up and go to church. Not I was sad, I was glad. So part of that is our modeling again. We keep coming back to that. It's not a big guilt thing, but it's just a reality. If we don't go to church because we stayed out too late the night before, we've just modeled that church isn't really as important as the party we went to. I like sports. Some of you have played sports. A lot of you have children in sports. We work with the Patriots every week during their season, with their team, work with, so we understand all that. But here's the deal. If you say, we really would like our kids to be involved in church, but that's when they play soccer. You know, if I got a dollar for every time I had a parent tell me that's why their kids weren't at church, be a rich man. I'd love it if a parent ever said, we really wanted our child to play soccer, but it's on Sunday. What's the priority? Well, we really think it's more important that our kids play soccer so they're not left out than that they learn conviction. That's what we're saying. Now, I'm not against playing. I realize there are exceptions at different times, but your kids aren't that good. They're not going to go anywhere with it. And if they get into the professional league, 80%, isn't it 80% of NFL players, 2 years after they leave football, are bankrupt, divorced, or unemployed?
And most all three.
And many big linemen are dead. Right?
Or crippled and maimed for life.
So why are you pushing your kids so much at such a young age? All three of our girls did sports. We love sports, but it's a priority. Our oldest daughter was a figure skater, and she was told she had to skate every Saturday all day if she wanted to really make it to the top. We said, well, I guess she won't make it to the top then. Because we're not going to sacrifice our family's Saturdays for 4 years, whatever, for skating. There's a higher priority. See that? Okay. And now Virginia will soften my statements.
I think that one's a little hopeless. But what I will say is I would challenge you to do what the town next door to us did in New England, the town of Reading, said, we don't want our kids playing soccer on Sunday mornings. Because interestingly, though, Massachusetts leads the nation in our liberal politics, they are very family-oriented at the end of the day. There are families in New England that all live, all the kids have grown up, and they live within a mile of home and think they've really left home. It's amazing. And so they just said, we don't want our Sundays wrecked with sports. And they passed an ordinance in their town that they cannot have any children's sports leagues that start before noon on Sunday. They still play. They play Sunday afternoon, but they have preserved Sunday morning. I thought, you know what, we've rolled over and played dead, and we've let everybody else tell us where to put the priorities in our lives, and we just jump in the stream and swim. I love the statement that any old dead fish can float downstream. It takes a live, vigorous one to swim against the current. And I feel like we need to be live, vigorous fish that are swimming against the current. It doesn't mean your kids can't be in sports, but I will bang on that drum as long as I can, that especially in these younger years, some of you are spending, you're losing your minds because you have two or three kids. And even if you've only said you can only be in one sport, you're still spending all of your time at practices or at games. You're eating your meals on the road, in the car, at fast food restaurants. You can't wait till the season's over. And I want to just tell you, life does not have to be that way. In fact, I'll go one step further and say our personal conviction is let them be children. Let them run and jump and play and develop their bodies in normal cross-training sort of ways that happen when they play jump rope and when they play basketball with you and when they run in the streets and when they swim in the pools.
Not in the streets, like.
And We actually feel then when you need them to be fully consumed with the passion of a sport, and we think that happens in the junior high and high school years, so that they're not idly bored with life, getting into all sorts of other trouble, they won't be burned out or have their little bodies already seriously injured for the rest of their lives because of overuse injuries, which are happening at an alarming rate for our children that are playing year-round sports before their little bodies are really developed. That's enough of my bandwagon.
Ooh, I thought you were going to soften it a little bit. So, two more things on church. One of our great mentors said when he was in junior high, he went to his dad and said, "Dad, I think church is boring. I'm not going to go anymore." And his dad said, "Well, son, where are you going to be living then?" So it's just a non-negotiable. You live in our house, we go to church. That's what we do. Now, let me follow it really quickly with, I think there are times where we need to have a very, very close ear to our children, especially adolescents, in a church that is vital and meeting their needs. I counseled a man this last year. He's in a church of 30. He's been in it for 20 years. He has teenagers. They're struggling. And I said, "Get out of the church." I said, "What are they seeing about vitality?" And he said, "But if we leave the church, you know, we've been there forever." I said, "The church will probably die, which would be a wonderful thing." Should have died years ago. But if you go to a vital church, your children may really get excited about the Lord. So obviously not one that isn't preaching the gospel, but go where there's vitality. Go where the program is going to help them love the Lord. Then help them have good friends. Proverbs 12:5, "The plans of the righteous are just, but the advice of the wicked is deceitful." 1 Corinthians 15:33, "Do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character." I can't remember if I said this Monday, but good friends don't ask you to do bad things. Your child says, "Well, my good friend and I," and they did something wrong. Say, "Oh, so he's not a good friend." And that goes for us as adults too. Good friends don't ask you to do bad things. It contradicts the definition of a good friend. A lot of parents, again, say, "But I can't affect who my kids' friends are." Well, sure you all can. You say, "You cannot play with that child." "Oh, but what if I offend their parents?" Well, we don't want to take that lightly, except ultimately your responsibility is your children, not the neighbors. We had a rule in our home. If our girls came home from someplace in worse shape than they left, then they weren't allowed to go there again for a while, because they were showing that they were being influenced rather than being an influencer. And we just said to them, "You know, you're just not strong enough because you came home with this language, this attitude, whatever." And so, but that doesn't mean you don't have a heart for your community. It just means you become more center of that.
And so that's it. For those of you who think, "Ooh, we just cut them off from all these people," that really wasn't true. We just would have those children come and play at our house, because what we found was that there are an awful lot of parents who assume that video games or DVDs or other activities would be self-policing for the children, and they wouldn't really disrupt their life very much to have them at their house. We felt it was kind of important to know what was going on when our children, and I'm talking especially elementary age, although I will tell you that when our kids were in junior high and high school, a lot of their friends wanted to come to our house because Paul was constantly making chocolate chip cookies, and we just had fun things to do. I won't tell you that we had a trampoline that we very carefully guarded, but there were things that kids like to come to our house and do. It takes our involvement, which is part of the reason that that's sometimes a harder choice for us. Sometimes we're very happy to offload our children to somebody else's care. And there can be really good reasons to do that, as long as you have confidence that that environment is going to be a good, healthy environment for them. The other thing under this, help them to have good friends, is be praying for and be very intentional about having some older mentoring-type children in your children's lives. This is part of the reason we know some of you come to Campus by the Sea, because our counselors are people that your kids think are pretty cool, and we think that they're worth imitating. They're great kids. But I will tell you that one of our sources of cross-checking and hiring our staff has become Facebook. Because we know that if your kid has a Facebook account, they're probably going to follow up with their counselor after they leave camp, and they're going to want to be their friend. And we had more than a few applicants that whose applications didn't really line up with their Facebook walls, with what they were saying on them, with their own personal thoughts. But there can be some wonderful mentoring that happens when you have older kids who are really in love with Jesus, who come alongside your kids. If our children were in here speaking tonight, they could name you a list of kids who largely were CBS counselors when they were young. And I will never forget when Carrie was 13, one of our staff was at Gordon, she was at Westmont College, she came back to Gordon College on an exchange semester. And I'll never forget Christina taking Carrie out for a soda. When Carrie came back, she was so excited about the things that Christine had told her. She said, "Mommy, you will not believe it. Christine is 22, and she has still not had a serious boyfriend. She's really not even kissed anybody yet. She is planning to not kiss the man she marries until she's engaged to him. Can you even believe that? I think that's the coolest thing I've ever heard." And the way she was saying it was as though it was a news flash with information she had never heard in her life. Now, that is our specialty. We have been teaching her that since she was a tiny little girl. And it took everything in me to not say, "You think that's the first time you've heard that? Are you kidding me?" I just smiled and I said, "That is so great, Carrie. I'm so glad Christine is in your life," because I really, really was. And, you know, eventually the girls were in Christina's wedding, and Christina and her four children and her wonderful husband come to family camp. And I cannot tell you the value of having Christinas in our daughters' lives through the years. They will be able to hear things from those kids that they sometimes cannot hear from us.
So do you see what's happening here? Our children have their convictions. They're in the church. They're associating with people that love Jesus. And as they get older, they're continuing. That's the pool of people they're associating with. And so when they go to college, they look for an InterVarsity group or a Campus Crusade group or a Vital Church that they're in every Sunday, because that's the pool of people they want to associate with. So when they start being attracted to somebody, there's a much better chance it's going to be somebody who is of like character and conviction. If they're going to the club, there's a pretty good chance it's not going to be. But it's they're going to make that choice. And it's largely as we've helped them, as we have helped plan this for them. Then help them embrace service and help them realize their happiness is really not the central issue. That's tough, isn't it? That's tough for us. I talked about this Monday night a little bit. It's not about my happiness. But, you know, if they learn how good service is, they learn how important serving is, the joy in serving. That's a huge deal. I was just reading this afternoon 1 Corinthians 13. I have read it before. But, you know, it struck me today, and I'm maybe very embarrassed to say this, unless none of you have ever thought of it, then I'm pretty excited. But why don't you read here what love is? Okay, verse 4, I think it starts. Love is patient.
Love is patient.
Okay, stop. Thank you. Why does it say love is patient? Because your spouse is going to tick you off. Right? Okay, next.
Love is kind.
Right, because you're going to want to be mean. Because your inclination, she or he is not nice all the time. And you don't want to be kind.
It does not envy.
Does not envy? Of course you envy, because you want something better than him. Not you personally, I'm just... Go ahead.
It does not boast.
Does not boast. Yeah, it's not about themselves. It's not pushing themselves up, putting their spouse down.
It is not proud.
Right, because their tendency is to be proud as a... spouse. Go ahead.
It is not rude.
Why would anybody be tempted to be rude? Maybe because our spouse is a jerk.
It is not self-seeking.
Oh, that sounds like it's sacrificial almost. Okay, go ahead.
It is not easily angered.
Oh, and what could anger anybody who's married to the love of their life? Which would not be a natural thing. None of us would ever think of keeping records, right? Okay.
Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in truth.
Oh, yeah, because we really want to be honest all the time. We're always speaking honestly to each other. That's our natural tendency, right?
It always protects.
Uh-huh.
Always trusts.
Uh-huh.
Always hopes.
Uh-huh.
Always perseveres.
Uh-huh. That's good. Okay, what you know what struck you about that? Why does anybody read this at a wedding? I said, this says you're about to go into something that is really hard. I mean, everything you're asked to do is against your natural tendency. Your wife's gonna tick you off. Your husband's gonna this. That's not in our notes, I know. But I just had to say that because it is the nature of sacrifice and service that's going to make us good mates. If we are catering to everything for our kids, if they're not sacrificing, if they're not doing without, if we're getting them everything, if we're sending them McDonald's coupons before they eat with the pigs so they don't have to suffer, you know, we're not helping them get ready for marriage. And because we're living in one of the most entitled ages ever, go ahead.
Did you?
No, we're not going to soften that one.
No. A very interesting phenomenon actually has emerged, though, in the last couple of years as the first generation of those children who were raised under the great self-esteem movement, which was going to change everything. Remember, that was if you're in teaching, you know that this was injected into the public schools in around the early 80s to mid 80s. And so we've now we're into our third decade of kids who have been raised believing that they are the center of their own universe. And what they're discovering is that when one center of one universe marries another one, there is an awful lot of competition for whose center is gonna win. And that's part of what is feeding into the dismal outlook for marriage for the 20-something generations. Many of them are choosing to not marry and cohabitate. We're living in the age with the highest rate of cohabitation that our world has ever seen. We're delaying marriage. The average age of marriage is now 27.2 in America. And part of there's no rush to the altar because we're sleeping with anybody we want to sleep with anyway. And so why bother? In our own counseling practice, we have had a significant increase in the number of couples we are seeing who have been married for less than 3 years. We've had couples in their first year of marriage who believe they are going to call it quits because they don't know how to be married. And you don't know how to be married if the only thing you've ever heard is that the only thing that really matters in life is that you get what you want. And nothing could be farther from the heart of God when it comes to marriage. In fact, Howard and us were talking the other day that we've actually gone through in the Christian publishing world probably 3 decades of the simple formula, how to get what I want and be happy in marriage type of books. I think that we've finally come to the end of believing that marriage can be so simply boiled down to a formula that will make sure that I get what I want. And the new genre of books that is coming out falls along the lines of Sacred Marriage. Gary Thomas, What If God Designed Marriage to Make You Holy More Than Happy? John Piper's book last year, This Momentary Marriage, Ray really challenges us to live above the fray with a view backwards of eternity as we live out our marriages. And a book that I'm going to plug tomorrow by Paul David Tripp entitled, What Did You Expect? It's just a great look. Once again, what is the heart of marriage? What is the purpose of marriage? And if we plant the ideas in the minds of our own little children that this world is about them and that their happiness is our only real concern, we will be raising up a generation of those who will find it impossible to be married, just like those around us now.
Wrapping up last couple here, help them understand commitment and covenant. We're just living in such a challenged culture as far as understanding commitment. It can be as simple as our children when they sign up for something. It's a, you know, for 6 months on a team or whatever, and they get in it, say we don't like it. We say, okay, you don't have to be in it. No, you made a, we need to explain it. And if you do this, you stay in it the whole time, whether you like it or not. We just are not teaching commitment. So we get into marriage and I don't like this. I never had to stay in anything I didn't like before. My parents even got me out of classes. They changed teachers because it's always somebody else's fault. Instead of just saying, you know, sweetheart, buck up. Our daughter Julie hated college her first year. And we just said, you're in it. We'll evaluate at the end of the year. It wasn't quite that simple. But that was the bottom line. It's you're not coming home. And we're sorry, it's tough.
And the concept of covenant is...
We did say that, didn't we?
Yeah, we did say that, yeah. And she did stay.
Yeah.
And covenant, for us to model again, remember that Moore's often taught, so our view of the covenant, we just pray by God's grace that divorce is not in your vocabulary. That you don't see that as you entered this marriage relationship, you left at least one door slightly ajar that you could escape. And we understand that there are some situations where divorce is the lesser of two evils. We know that. We are marriage counselors. But the vast majority of people who end their marriages do not do it for biblical reasons. They do it because they're entitled to more happiness than they're getting in that relationship. And they're pretty sure if they just change partners, they're going to find it in somebody else. If they study the statistics, they'd stick in their first marriage because second marriages fail at a significantly increased rate than first marriages fail, and third marriages even more than that. The solution really isn't finding a different person. Very often it's becoming a different person, and that becoming a different person is becoming more Christ-like. We would say that if there's anything that will change your marriage, it would be that each one of you would take seriously the call to Christ-likeness. Because if you study the life of Christ, if we act like Christ towards one another in our marriages, let me just tell you, we wouldn't be wanting to leave our marriages.
And then lastly, help them understand forgiveness. It's never too late to start doing the right thing. And we just want to say, even in the area of divorce that we've talked about, realize that some of you are divorced that are here. And as we're talking about it, it isn't, we can't change history. History's written, it's over. So that our hearts are never to go back for guilt and remorse, but to always look forward for what God has for us. Do you see that? And so that's always where we're going. And our children need to know that. That they're going to make mistakes. And we want them to have that relationship with us that they can come to us. That we're people who confess, as Virginia said, we're forgiven sinners. They know that so well. We want them to be able to come to us. We want them to understand that there is complete forgiveness, no matter where they are, what they've done. And no matter where we are and what we've done in our marriages, we can model that for them. And I think as we do this, we... You know, again, there are no guarantees, but there are probabilities. Our verse, as I said, as we started, 3 John verse 4, that I have no greater joy. And we have to ask ourselves, what really is our greatest joy? Is our joy that our children are going to walk in the truth? If that's really true, then we start rearranging our lives to do everything so that we'll live as joyful parents and grandparents, right? We see way too many people who are... their children are adults and they're not living in much joy because their kids are making such poor decisions. And often it's because the parents have not made good decisions in raising them earlier. So again, not a prescription that's a guarantee, but a challenge to just think about how we're doing.
And remember that perfection is not incumbent on us as parents. There's no possibility of us going through this life perfectly. We are broken, broken people. I think one of the most important things that our kids have ever said, it was right down here on the Stony Beach at Campus by the Sea. I think Julie was 15 at the time, and one of the moms, might even be in this room, said to her, Julie, what do you think it is that helped you girls? At that time, they were 15, 17, and 19, almost 20, and all very involved in ministry here and seeking God with their lives. What's the secret, I think, was the question. And this particular woman said, I've just observed a lot of ministry families that where the kids have just gone sideways. What do you think made the difference? And I will never forget Julie's answer. I could actually still hear better at that time, and I was sitting about 10 yards off the beach from her, and she didn't know it. And she said, well, she said, I really think that what one of the most important things was that we saw God changing our parents, and that gave us great hope that he could change us. And I share that with you because what was so meaningful to me was that she was acknowledging that there was a whole lot of work that needed to be done in our lives and that continues to be done in our lives. And that what gave her hope of pursuing this God of the universe was that there is evidence that he was real in our lives because they could see us being changed into more Christ-likeness. So you know two things. One is that we're just like you in need of sanctification. And two, that's inviting to our children rather than repelling to them. And I think that's the greatest word of hope that we can probably give you.
Let's pray. Father, thank you for the incredible gift of having children. What a responsibility as well. And we pray that you will equip us, that you'll give us wisdom, discernment, and great joy as we do our best to create an environment most conducive to our children choosing to follow you. In Christ's name.